Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Inside New Miami Medicine. I am guest hosting today. My name is Latha Chandran. I am the Executive Dean for Education and the Chair of the Department of Medical Education here at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. And I'm delighted to present to you Dr. Anna Palacio, who is one of our faculty members. But let me give you a proper introduction. Dr. Palacio is a professor of clinical medicine and the director of the University of Miami Program in Research Education and the co-director of the Resident Scholarly Activity Program here. She serves as a clinical researcher in long COVID and health disparities and currently serves as the co-director of the Miami VA Long COVID Clinic. Welcome to the program, Dr. Palacio.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. So you have had a fascinating journey across two continents, being born in one, raised in the other, coming back for education in the second one, right? How did you develop your passion for medicine, your approach towards medicine, and how has that bicontinent growth helped you in that or influenced you?
Well, that's such an interesting question. And I reflect on it lately, and I think it has been kind of like the perfect blend for me in my personal journey and really has shaped my passions in medicine. So I was born here while my father was training, doing his residency in internal medicine and cardiology. But when we went back with this dream of changing, improving the way we taught and practiced medicine in Ecuador, my home country. And he was a dreamer, but he had by his side my mother, who is a force of nature. And
yes,
they became like this power team and developed over the years an institute that trained most of the cardiologists in my country. So that was part of my daily life, was how do we do better? How do we give access to more patients? How do we attract trainees? And so it was kind of a natural progression. It was kind of like not even a question in my mind that was kind of like, was the business of the family, education and equity. So for me, it was kind of natural to come back to the U.S. to do my training. And it was my dream to train in, you know, evidence-based medicine. And it was lately that I really reflected on really all that I gained in medical school over there. Because as you know, and you probably have gone through the same, you know, Ecuador is a developing country or a developing economy. And because of that, patients do not have access to all the tests. So many times the tests are not even available or patients cannot afford them. So we really, over the 6 years that is medical school over there, the curricula really emphasized physical exam and history taking, and all the courses had a lot of practice, honing in those skills. So you really had to choose wisely, what are you ordering?
I can so relate to that because I was in a similar, you know, I did my medical training in India and went to medical school at 18 in the 6 years. So everything you talk about, I can relate to. How did that help you think about healthcare holistically and your focus on health disparities? How did that evolve?
So it was kind of like the training as in a medical school. It was, you needed really to consider the social context of patients, you know, because they could be coming from completely different backgrounds. I'm sure the same for you in India. So you really needed to think about who is this person and what is the best way to whatever they need to make sure that this therapeutic approach was feasible, acceptable to them. So that was kind of part of life in a country like Ecuador, and I'm sure it's the same in India. So for me, that was natural. When I came here, I started to recognize that it was a lot less, especially when I trained, a few years ago, but it wasn't as evident that we are considering the social context. And when I had to decide on my fellowship, I started thinking about cardiology because my father is a cardiologist and it was kind of like what you know you like.
So you were thinking about becoming a cardiologist all along.
I was thinking about that.
Something happened when you were at Hopkins.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So when I was deciding my fellowship and I started looking into the programs, everyone was telling me, you know, you are going to get 9 months of cath lab, 10 months of cath lab. And I started, you know, I don't want 9 or 10 months of cath lab. So I started thinking, what do I like? What do I love? And I went back to this being in Ecuador, when I was able to provide equitable care, when I was able to connect with a patient and make sure that even though the resources were scarce, they would get a good treatment. And the same here during my training here. So I was really confused. So I decided to go to Hopkins because this fellowship, it was kind of like they develop your research skills and it's a general medicine fellowship with a master's in public health, but you are meant to find your passion there. So I said, well, that's what I'm going to do. And I went and I just started doing research in health disparities with people, really important people that I learned so much from, Lisa Cooper, Fred Brancati. And then it was kind of like this aha moment that you are thinking, I'm going to learn from the best place how to solve health disparities. And basically you get there and you realize nobody knows how to solve health disparities, not even this giant. And basically what we are learning is how to listen better, how to engage community. And that was the lesson.
Yeah, no, I had my MPH at Johns Hopkins as well. And I know the expertise that's there, and at least a focus on those kinds of, you know, the social determinants of health and how all those affect everyday patient health was definitely built into that curriculum. So how did you take that? Tell us about your journey from Hopkins to UN and how you started with the geocoding piece, which is very fascinating. You can explain that a little in detail because people need to understand that.
So yeah, so it really began out of necessity because, you know, in the middle of all this, and my father had become the vice president of my country. And he had been working with Hopkins before when he was Minister of Health when I was a medical student and developed a blueprint of health reform.
Okay.
So I was in my starting my MPH and my father becomes the vice president. And the Hopkins team seeks me out and says, okay, you should be part of the team because you're a perfect liaison, et cetera, et cetera. So we went back to Ecuador and and we needed to develop a network of clinics, integrating what was there and finding the gaps to create whatever facilities and resources were needed in different parts of the country.
So you did this during your fellowship?
During my fellowship, it was kind of, how do we figure out where to put a clinic?
And what a fascinating opportunity you got.
Incredible. And the other thing is, there was not, at that stage, there was not a lot of geocoding software. They didn't exist.
Yeah.
But my father was the president. So I was blessed that, you know, he said, okay, we're going to do this. We got this idea. We geolocate where the clinics are and what services they provide. We could find geographically the needs. Where do we put the clinic? So we started, but there were no maps. So, but the Army has maps. The Navy has maps. So I got access to these maps that were kind of official maps. And I started overlaying census data, overlaying things, some things manually. And that was the first geocoding. You know, that was my thesis for my capstone at Hopkins School. You know, it won an award because you can imagine just for effort. They put me an A for effort.
If you ask flowers, probably you were ahead a few times as well, right? Yeah, we're not thinking of geocoding. Which year are you talking about?
This is 2003.
Yeah, so people are not, this was not a commonly done thing. Now you have all these GIS systems and, you know, much more visual spatial mappings and stuff, but then you didn't have that.
There wasn't.
But that laid the groundwork for you when you came here. So tell us about your bio.
When I came here, I had already done this geocoding work in Ecuador where we decided where to put the clinics based on this. And also, but I learned quite a bit about the neighborhoods in Ecuador. So I figured when we came here, I already was certain that I wanted to work in health disparities. And Dr. Lani Gardner, who actually recruited me back to Miami, was also supportive of that. The problem was that there was no data. There were no data, so there was anywhere. So it was like, how do we do health disparities work when you don't know who is what? And so this opportunity came along. I was meeting with Lani Gardner like weekly, thinking about how do we get disparity data or race and ethnicity data, income data? And an opportunity came along to work with Humana Innovation Center, and we created, and we kind of were brainstorming in like a setting like this, and we were like, what could we do? And I was telling them about my experience in Ecuador and said, okay, the census has a lot of information. The issue is how do we use it? And these people from Humana said, we can do it. Let's do it. So we created a center and we started integrating data from the census, from UHealth, and from Humana, and overlaying the same thing that I had done in Ecuador, overlaying information. And we assigned to the page, to the participants in a database or a UHealth, based on the census, we assigned likelihood of being of certain race, ethnicity, or income. And then we validated it.
I see.
And so that was the first, and then we kind of started looking at outcomes using those kind of like imputed variables. And we found incredible, you know, a wealth of information about disparity. So,
yeah. So if you wanted to tell us, again, I commend you on having that vision of doing this in a way advanced before people are thinking about it. Actually, even though the infrastructure wasn't there, you've brainstormed and figured out a way to do that. So congratulations on that, right? But can you tell us in maybe two or three sentences what the key findings were? And did you have any surprise in that, or was it just validating what you already knew about social determinants?
Yes, yeah, so it's been, you know, 8 years of work, good work here at UHealth. We have done the geocoding. We have collected social determinants of health from patients, from a survey. So what kind of like the big, the headlines have been, you know, that race, ethnicity, income predict most any outcome. So it's not only cardiovascular, which was what I started looking at, but you look at any outcome, you're going to find disparities. But the surprise has been that even, you know, we view this as a complete as a neighborhood thing. Like if you say a neighborhood that is wealthy is fine, and a neighborhood that is not wealthy is, you know, is at risk. And that in general is true, but within neighborhoods, you find people that are resilient and people that are at risk. So even in wealthy neighborhoods, you have people that are failing and you don't know their personal stories, but they are, you know, struggling. When you ask them in the survey, they are having financial distress, even though they're living in a area that is considered wealthy. So the lesson for me has been, even though I, you know, promote the use of geocoding, that when you're a physician, a practicing physician, you need to consider the whole person. You need to ask them, what are your struggles? Because you, that might be the person that even though maybe in the books, in the paper look perfect, they may be struggling.
So I think that you're bringing up a very important point, right? We always think about populations and communities, but healthcare is delivered at the individual level. And what you're saying is that we can't homogenize a group because they are in one zip code or they are Hispanic or African-American or whatever, but every person is unique. Exactly. And it's the physician's responsibility to find out what is it that's their situation. So let's get back to you, right? You are right now very engaged in the long COVID process, right? You have set up a clinic, which I also want to hear about. But tell me about how your own personal life has informed your interest and work in this long COVID area before we talk about the clinic?
Yeah, great question. And it has so many, there are a lot of factors, but there are mainly two big factors. One was that when I was doing my research, I had found that even though I was thinking about access and equitable access, but when actually I had all the data, there was this big black box of unknowns.
Yeah.
Social determinants of health impact in some way that is independent what the outcomes are. So, and this black box, when I was reading, it was, they call it the allostatic load, meaning some cumulative burden of things that influence your biology. And there are a lot of theories about, is this an immune dysfunction, or what does this immune or this allostatic load does to the biology that creates epigenetic changes. So this was, you know, 10 years ago, was a lot about this, what is this black box? So how this influences biology? And I was looking, trying to find that. And then, you know, something happened in my personal life that kind of like said, oh, here it is. This is what happens. This is the black box. My own daughter developed chronic fatigue syndrome, but that diagnosis happened years after we had tried many things. She started developing autoimmune conditions and a lot of allergies.
And I want to, you know, ask you about this chronic fatigue syndrome, right? There's a tendency for us in general, when we don't understand a complex disease, to easily rub it off, brush it off as maybe psychogenic or something, right? And people who suffer with those kinds of diseases, multimodal diseases, where you really don't have a clarity of understanding because nobody really understands them. And they, you know, so I'm sure you, as you were navigating with your daughter, her chronic fatigue syndrome, felt some of that, right?
So completely. I mean, she was really a child. She was 12 years old when we started with the first diagnosis that she had food allergies. Mm. Then different things, different diagnoses over the years. And we were wondering, how is this possible? A healthy child in a healthy environment, in those, you know, perfect, in textbook, perfect environments. And yet she's suffering and we get dismissed. You know, when we ask the question about, is this connected to the other diagnosis? Everyone is like, no, she just has bad luck. And we were like, well, this cannot possibly be bad luck. I mean, and I overlap with this issue of me looking for the black box. And I was like, oh, here it is. Something is triggering everything. And things are connected, no? It's not that, you know, the immune system is related to the autonomic nervous system and it's related to the GI system. It's not that siloed.
Right.
It's one orchestra. And then finally, after years, she got diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And the doctor that saw her, Nancy Klimas, told us she probably is exposed to mold in Florida. That'd be my bet. That's what she said. And I was like, well, in my house, there is no mold. But she said, find it. And it was it. We found mold. And when we moved, she started improving. And from being with kind of very disabled, she's very functional now. And that really inspired me. I had to learn a lot. I had to be humble about everything that I didn't know about how all the systems are really connected. And it's kind of like a house of cards. One thing starts coming down, the whole thing comes crashing down.
So that you can relate that to what's happening in COVID right now. Right. So when COVID started, everybody was panicking because nobody knew what exactly the pathophysiology was with this disease or which all systems it could be affected. I don't think we still have a clear answer on that. But tell me how you arrived to that long COVID, you need to do something about it.
So the moment that we started talking about disparities, correct? So COVID began and we started saying, you know, Hispanics, African-Americans, communities of color are facing the brunt of the death and the morbidity. And obviously having, you know, this issue of the allostatic load to me made perfect sense. You know, these are communities that maybe experiencing accumulation of adversities since they are born, stressors or environmental or economic, all sort of stressors. And now their immune system is kind of primed to react in a more severe way. So in the acute phase, I would say, well, that's what's going on, you know, and obviously they also have more hypertension and more diabetes because it's one thing. It's all these inflammatory conditions are related to each other. They are, it's kind of like there is a common thread. And then I began, when this, and we actually did a geocoding study and we plotted in Miami using the survey that UM has done and the geocoded, and we found that neighborhoods were having the brunt, you know,
of the COVID
epidemic.
I see.
So then I was like, well, if we are correct in this hypothesis, this is going to lead to chronic fatigue syndrome. There is no question about it. So I started applying for funds to create a clinic in September of 2020 because I knew, you know, that if there was kind of, you have the ingredients for a cake, you are going to make a cake. There is no way around it. And the ingredients were all there. And so yeah, that's how I kind of like.
In a sense, it is really your experience with your daughter and her, you know, vague symptoms and the unifying theme that came together that primed you to think about long COVID in the same way that it's part of the same system and go ahead and start the clinic, right?
Exactly. I mean, it was those things that you find, you know, we see there, do you believe in the universe? You know, that things happen for a reason. Which I never used to think about that. But when I look back to every piece of my life, it's like I've come to this moment having a lot of different tools, you know, that I have built to this moment where it's asked of me to do something for people that are going to be misled in what they really are facing, because that's what I had the experience with my own daughter, that we don't have the tools as providers to diagnose these conditions. We were not trained on this. Right. And it's unfair to us as well, providers, because we want to do good by our patients, but we don't have the resources or the training. So that's how I was motivated to try to disseminate that. At least the VA, in the VA system, you have the advantage of having kind of like a kind of universal health insurance model where, you know, it's funded. And if the veterans are in need, they will create it. So that was, I was starting to tell them, we're going to need it. We're going to need it. And for a few months, they said, nah, maybe. But then when the patients started showing up with all these multi-symptom, unexplainable symptoms, they said, oh, Paulana, she was saying that we were going to need something.
So all of a sudden, your long make originates. It's fascinating to think about how your personal and professional experiences together shape and evolve into, you know, what you are today and what your career focus has been, right? So tell us a little bit about your experiences with the long COVID clinic at the VA. What have you learned? What do people come in with, right? It's a disease that people don't know, and you don't know much. I don't even know even lesser than that. How do you, what do they come with, and how do you relate to them and give them some help?
Go ahead. Yes. So the first message is that many patients do not know that they have long COVID. The providers do not know that they have long COVID. So usually it was at first districtling of patients from primary care providers, because we advertise, we have a long COVID clinic. We could, and we say, you know, you could have like 200 symptoms have been cited from patient-led research in Europe. But if you have unexplainable symptoms, just refer them. We will do the evaluation. Mm-hmm. So we started having this trickling of patients from referrals of primary care providers. And everyone was like, what do I have? They even though the term long COVID, long hauler was already out, they are not connecting the dots, because it's kind of like this presentation of symptoms that are vague and they don't look like anything. It's like, oh, and now I cannot function. I cannot eat what I eat. I cannot do the things I used to do. I cannot exercise. I cannot think. Mm-hmm. So it's like, but it's not kind of like a disease that anyone can
have. Know the diagnosis and say, okay, this is...
And the last words usually are normal.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, what is going on? Mm. And now we are screening patients, because the VA really, we need to really commend the VA from kind of like creating the resources quickly. So now they really are advocating that we screen veterans. So we are sending a digital screening. Mm-hmm. And now it's us and there are other four sites in the US that are sending to 200, 300 veterans per week a screener.
And so anybody who had COVID gets a screen.
Exactly. And now once we're done with the people that we know had COVID, we're going to move to everyone. Because some people now don't know that if they had COVID or not, and it becomes milder. But yes, so the patients, when we tell them, this is what we think you have, and this is what is going on, and we do have a lot of different services. One is that we have kind of a group seminar where we explain what is the theories behind long COVID. They really feel better just by being recognized, and by us telling them, we believe you. Just that, it's help. But beyond that, we do have a protocol for, basically you have this immune dysfunction and autonomic nervous system dysfunction. Mm-hmm. So we kind of have a protocol to calm down the immune system using either medications or also environmental changes, behavioral things to try to diminish the amount of insult stressors to the immune system, and also kind of an autonomic nervous system program using a variety, also breathing, meditation, vagus nerve stimulators, medications like beta blockers when they have postural tachycardia. But so we do have like a really nice program that is really a shared decision-making process. Mm-hmm. And we try to hear, what are your priorities? What is the symptom that most bother you? And try to engage them in this long journey of healing. It's long because people need to learn how to be patient. They try to, if they feel a little better one day, they push. And if they push, the house of cards comes crashing down again. So this issue of what we now hear, pacing, this rest, do less, requires a lot of fortitude, mental fortitude, to accept this is not the person that I used to be, but I need to be grateful for who I am now and trust that I maybe get back to where I was, but not constantly thinking all on that, because that gets them very depressed and anxious.
So this was a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us. And also, I want to wish you that, you know, you find good results for your long COVID, and hopefully, because there's going to be a lot of patients affected by it, and hopefully what we learn here at the University of Miami can then be used to help a lot of patients who have long COVID.
Yeah, I want to mention one thing, if I may, that we also, I'm also the co-PI of a study, a cohort study happening in South Florida. And so that is a longitudinal study trying to evaluate the trajectory of long COVID symptoms. It's funded by the CDC. It's called COVID-19, Understanding the Postviral Phase. We're having a lot of struggles recruiting, mainly because people do not know that they have it. So if anyone sees a patient like that, we do have these studies recruiting from all health systems, and anyone that has fatigue qualifies. So that'll be, you know, a little bit of a pitch that if anyone has patients, it will be very helpful to refer them.
That's fantastic. That's a nice conversation that people who hear it, if they have an issue, they can call and come and join us. So thank you so much, Dr. Palacio. To our wonderful listeners, please join us for another round. I hope you enjoyed this. Again, we'll be coming back soon with another edition of Inside U Miami Medicine. Thank you.
Thank you.